Thank you, and good evening. Welcome to tonight's Monroe City Council meeting. The time right now is 7:01 p.m. Ms. Atkinson, would you please call the roll?
Certainly, council members present and establishing a quorum are Scarborough, Cutaback, Sanford, Rasmussen, Davis, Camp, and Gamble.
Thank you, and I forgot to read the heading first. Again, this is the Monroe City Council meeting for January 23rd, 2018, and the roll has been read, and Ms. Atkinson, thank you for doing that. And then, Councilmember Cutaback, will you please lead us in the pledge?
I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Thank you. The first item that we have on our agenda this evening is under announcements and presentations. This is a presentation from our Snohomish County Executive, Dave Summers. Executive Summers, thank you for coming this evening.
Thank you, Mayor. Pleasure to be here. Good to see you all. Happy New Year. It seems like it was a long time ago, but still Happy New Year. Kind of wanted to go over, just give you an update. We'll come back to this in a minute. A few topics I wanted to touch bases on tonight. First is what we're doing at the county with opioids and homelessness, and hope to engage you and the other cities in the county in an effort. And I'm going to turn it over in just a minute to Alexander Durham, who works in my office and is helping to lead up those efforts. But also, we'll touch on just some transportation projects, a land use planning symposium that we have coming up in just a few weeks to talk about the future growth in Snohomish County. And then I also have my emergency management director, Jason Bierman, who needs to give an update on Department of Emergency Management. And finally, I also have Tom Titan here. What's Tom? Where are you?
Yeah.
Our parks director to talk about a couple of parks projects and answer any questions you have. But last fall, we had an idea at the county that really came out of the sheriff's office to use emergency management techniques and systems to organize ourselves on the opioid homelessness issue. And the idea was really that we have structures set up through FEMA and the incident command system to organize multiple agencies around a natural disaster or emergency, avoid those during OSO and others. All our first responders are trained in this, government officials, fire departments, etc., know the system. So we stood up what's called a multi-agency committee. At first, you know, we wanted to try the concept, so we stood it up at the county to bring together the sheriff's office, my human services department, the city of Everett police department was there, our emergency management folks. So what we're hoping to do is engaging on this. I'm going to let Alexandra give you a little bit more detail on this, and then we'll come back and take some questions. Alexandra?
Yeah, okay, good. I'm trying to fix it from auto forward to manual forwarding.
Hey, good evening, council members, Mayor Thomas. You'll be hearing from me again a little bit later when we get into the training part. Alexander and I are going to talk briefly about how we're structuring our response to the opioid epidemic at the county level. Does this work? So just to give you a little bit of background before we go into that, we have responded to epidemics before. We plan for it as part of our emergency management processes. We factored into our planning when we do our comprehensive emergency management plan. We work closely with our partners at the health district. And even going back to 2009, some of you will remember the H1N1 crisis. We worked very closely with the health district and the city of Everett's Office of Emergency Management and actually stood up a joint EOC for that response. It's still doing that. So we have a history of doing this, both as a multi-jurisdictional effort and that it's incorporated into our planning. That plan that I talk about, that's something the city of Monroe has as well. A comprehensive emergency management plan is something that's required by the state of all jurisdictions. So within that, there are emergency support functions, functional areas. And what we did is we started looking at this crisis is identifying which agencies were critical to it, and then asking those agencies to come on board in a response similar to what we do with other disasters. And what that looks like, again, briefly, is each of those coordinating agencies in those functional areas will work with their other jurisdictional partners, with private nonprofits, with other agencies, to work within that function to bring some coordination to the efforts within it. For example, the health district is the coordinating agency for public health. That sort of makes sense. And that means they work with clinics, they work with hospitals, they work with veterinarians, they work with lots of different facets of public health to bring them together in a coordinated fashion. Then we bring all of them together, and that allows us to do a lot of crosstalk and cross-pollination. So within our Emergency Coordination Center, we bring those functional leads in along with other key partners. We support them with that outer ring you see around there. Those are my staff who help bring us through the process where we identify goals and objectives. And that's how we actually start collaborating and coordinating cross-functionally at a county level. These are the ones that we have activated for this process. We have our Public Works Department, a representative from our solid waste in there. There are obviously issues with the waste being generated by the crisis. Our fire and EMS partners are in there. They're obviously a key component of this because they're dealing with this in the pre-hospital setting. My staff, our Human Services Department, Alessandra and others from the Executives Department. The Health District has been a key partner in this, coming in with and coordinating not just within the district, but with the hospitals and with the Medical Examiner's Office as well. We engaged the Drug Task Force early on because they are actually out seeing this, you know, literally on the streets and firsthand. And the Sheriff's Office at large with their officers and deputies who are out in the communities. And then finally, the Sheriff's Office has taken the lead. Part of the collaborative effort that we have extends beyond just what we're doing cross-functionally, but that ESF 15 piece, our external affairs, the Sheriff's Office is leading an effort to bring public information officers from around the county. They met within the last couple weeks with 29 other public information officers to ensure that we're sharing messaging that's going out into the communities and maximizing how it gets out. Here are a list of the other agencies that are participating. There's quite a number, and certainly we're open to other partners, and Alessandra is going to talk about that as she gets into her part. And these are the goals that we established early on. So I'm going to turn it over to Alessandra to talk about some of the details of the goals that we've set, and then also some of the other things we've done where we can potentially partner with some of your agencies as well.
Good evening, Mayor and Council members. Again, thank you for having us here. So, as Jason mentioned, there's seven overarching goals over this opioid map group that we've created. And first and foremost, our goal is to reduce opioid misuse and abuse and all of the side effects of that. And then, as you'll see, we also have the overarching goals of lessening the availability of opioids, reducing criminal activity associated with opioid use. A major goal that we have is using data to detect, monitor, evaluate, and act upon the data that we have. It's coming from a variety of sources, so through collaboration, we're able to pull that together into one space and sort through using experts from a variety of jurisdictions and agencies to determine what is most useful in determining our course of action. Also reducing collateral damage to our community, so that's things like nuisance properties, needles, garbage, and waste that we're seeing on our playgrounds and in our neighborhoods. Providing information to the public about the response in a timely and coordinated manner. As you know, there's a lot of misconceptions and misinformation out there about opioid misuse and abuse and the side effects to our community. And so by having a coordinated response and a coordinated agency pulling together this information and dispersing, we're ensuring that everybody's getting the same information at the same time from the same source. And then lastly, ensuring that the availability of resources are efficiently and effectively available to support the response efforts. As we mentioned, the timeline of this, we actually began meeting in the summer of 2017, but officially launched on November 20th under Executive Summer's directive to DEM as well as his executive staff. We meet every Monday And then we also share updates with one another through Jason and his team every Wednesday so that we all have the same information at the same time. So the why behind this, and in no particular order, I think if we were to list it, first and foremost, it's the cost of lives in our community. So Snohomish County has roughly 10% of the state's population, and yet we experienced 14.5% of all opioid-related deaths and 16.7% of all heroin-related deaths in our state. And in 1 week alone, this past July, there were 37 overdoses that were reported within our county. Of those 37, 3 were fatal. And more alarming, this past October, in the course of a weekend, so 2 days, there were 10 individuals that died of overdoses in Snohomish County. So this is a count that we are hoping to repeat on a quarterly basis to gauge more effectively where we're at in our progress and our impact of this work on the community. The cost to local government, so to cities, tribes, the county, the state, is staggering. And those costs can be from everything to cleaning up nuisance properties to jail and ER visits, and then those pre-hospital visits like EMS and first responders, as well as treating opioid withdrawal in our jail and local hospital facilities. Also, you know, a key piece of this is breaking down silos, so ensuring that we really get together and share information rather than working in our own collective world. Increasing efficiencies amongst partners, and then again, identifying common themes and messaging and educational opportunities so that we're able to create more awareness about the scope of the problem. And so we already reached some success, and I'm really excited because Monroe was a part of the early success of the Office of Neighborhoods. But as you know, these units are specialized units with law enforcement and social workers working hand in hand. It's really a special group of folks. And so it's been successful in South County, it's been successful in Everett, it's been successful in Monroe to date, and so we are expanding within the next 60 days this program to the cities of Arlington as well as Marysville. And this allows us to get out into the community and do encampments on the streets where we know that this population is concentrated, and provide them with access to services such as treatment, housing, reunification with their family or community, jobs, and stability in a more efficient and timely manner. And these are just some pictures. There's a picture of the unit that's doing some of this work, as well as Arthur, who's in the corner here. He's one of the success stories of this program, a pretty dramatic turnaround in his life. And then this young gal right here, she was 30 years old. She gave us her permission to tell her story. She had been released from the jail, but there was nowhere else to go that she was aware of. So rather than going into treatment or seeking help, she ended up right back into the encampment and called back to her home. And so programs and the expansion of programs like the Office of Neighborhoods helps us to make certain that folks like this young lady aren't just released into the street when really what they're seeking is help. Narcan training, we're looking in 2018 at expanding our training and also maintaining the training that we do to the 21 law enforcement agencies in Snohomish County. To date, more than 900 officers have been trained and 700 community members. We're expanding these trainings to places like the general public, senior centers, because it was a population that has gone long ignored in terms of this crisis, as well as we just learned this past week on our bus drivers. And in terms of why this matters, as of October 2017, 122 lives have been saved in roughly a year and a half, 2 year period, and that number has gone up since October by a few. And those are just pictures of what the Narcan actually looks like, as well as some of our officers going through training. This is one that we're really excited about. So we are expanding a multidisciplinary approach to dealing with nuisance properties. So historically, you have the sheriff's office working on this, public works, planning and development services. Maybe cities are also working on this as well. But there wasn't a hub for all of these agencies to come together to tackle the program. So what we ended up finding was a tremendous backlog of complaints and nuisance properties throughout the county. One, just really, I guess, vibrant example of this was a property in Granite Falls that had 50 calls for service, an accidental shooting, drug activity, health and sanitation violations. But again, because these calls were going into multiple different agencies, we weren't able to address it quickly by pulling resources together and breaking down silos and having an open conversation. We're able to get these properties cleaned up and neighborhoods restored. And this is a picture of the property that I talked about. And as you can see, their neighbors are looking directly into their yards. And then this is one that is in process, but again, very excited about it. Snohomish County's goal is to open the Diversion Center by March 31st of 2018. This is a center that will provide 44 beds to address substance use disorder and opioid-related illnesses. So an example of how this could work is a team like the Office of Neighborhoods encounters somebody outside who is eager and willing to accept treatment and help, but as you know, that's a very limited resource in our region. And so rather than telling these folks, you know, check back with us every few days, which is really hard to do when you're unsheltered, we now have a facility where we can take them where they can begin to safely detox and receive medication-assisted treatment, as well as behavioral health services like counseling and a pathway forward for reintegration and inclusion in their families and their communities. So as of right now, Governor Jay Inslee has included $500,000 in his supplemental budget, and we're going through the legislative process now, advocating fiercely for this center. And again, these are just pictures of folks who, without the Diversion Center, are currently receiving medication-assisted treatment and other detox services within the county jail, which we all know is not what it was intended for. And then briefly, these are just kind of some bullet points of our successes, including trainings that we've done to 14 of the senior centers that are funded with county dollars, doing condensed training and providing that information for fire districts so people like community paramedics can go out into homes and educate people about opioid misuse and abuse, as well as Narcan training. And then also a huge component of this is the drug take-back program, which the sheriff's office and the health district have been instrumental in. Again, that communication piece is vital to the success of the opioid map group, so setting up a joint information system and center so that PIOs throughout the county can come together and work through the messaging. And then also just a list of contacts so people know who to talk to about this issue so they're not having to go to various places. And then these are just kind of in more in-depth highlights of those pieces that I talked about in regards to the senior center. And then as Jason talked about, there's also room for cities to participate in a couple ways that could work. Some cities are interested in using resources like their employees, people with expertise, to insert them within those areas of the MAC group that Jason discussed, the emergency support functions. So that could be the PIO or a police officer. It could be one of the social workers or human services expert. And integrate seeing them into the group so they have a part of the larger conversation. The other method that seems to work is also standing up something like this within your own jurisdiction, and then feeding information from your own type of MAP group into that larger group as well. Both of those are models that we're used to working with and equally as effective. And do you have any questions for myself or for Jason?
That's where we cut it back.
Thank you for coming. I just had a question about the goals. I don't know if you could put those back up. I can't remember how many you have, but they're pretty broad. So do you guys have specific metrics or how you're measuring, like, reduce opioid misuse and abuse is very broad?
Yes.
What does that look like? Do you then break that down to the different groups and they have different? Okay.
We do, and there's actually a handout that we brought with us, which we'll make sure is distributed to you. But these goals are intentionally broad, and then under each goal, there's several objectives. And so those do have measurable things like these or percentages. So, for example, if we say that we're going to reduce opioid misuse and abuse, the number there is 10%, and there's a specific date that's assigned to that.
Okay.
So that, and then we have what's called a planning cycle. So every 4 weeks, we come back together as a group, and we look at where we are on each of those objectives. And if refinement is necessary, then we do that. If it's completed, we'll take it off the list. Or if something new needs to be added in addition or in its place, then that'll be done at that time as well.
Okay. And where is the funding coming for this?
So there is no additional funding involved in this at the moment. It's been a lot of creativity and innovation, and again, just pulling together resources. So we found silos cost money. Yeah. So by breaking those down, it reduces a lot of the spinning of the wheels that we were doing and allows more time for the work. And then Jason and his team have been very generous with their planning staff.
Well, I think I saw a job posted at the county where you were looking for a lean consultant. Are you guys employing lean in, at the county level and doing that practice?
We are. We haven't to this purpose yet.
To this yet?
Yes, in our other departments we are.
Okay. All right. Thank you.
Councilmember Gamble?
I had the same question. I was just related to goals, and I quite heard a little bit. So there's, if you could go back one to the.
Yeah, sorry, this is because of my of its own.
No, so there is a site where we could actually go and look at the underlying things that are under these goals. I zeroed in on the goal number two, the lessen the availability of opioids, because we've seen presentations in the past on black market, you know, pipeline to Mexico, yep. And then there's the prescription, overuse of prescriptions, that type of stuff. I would love.
Yeah. Can I send
you? Yeah, one second.
Okay. Thank you all.
We'll so, copy that and make sure that you get.
Yeah, so there, these are. Here are all the objectives, and there are dozens underneath those goals.
Okay.
And we do, as Alessandra said, every month or every 4 weeks, we review them to see what's done and what we can take off. But,
But I just wanted to say that we were seeing agencies get across purposes and working inefficiently. The health district really took this on as a project last year in a big way, jumped in. And for example, who's going to do Narcan? The health district, the sheriff's offices, services. So this process really is one of allowing us to get everybody, as the sheriff likes to say, in their swim lanes and decide what those are and where the resources are best put. And so we're not at cross purposes. Data and what data you collect is a huge controversy. And we have a forum now for sitting down, deciding on that, focusing and aligning with our objectives, and everybody's, you know, pulling in the same direction. So no additional resources. We've told the people, you know, this is an organizational structure to coordinate us all, and then we can attach others to. I wanted to start big, kind of countywide. The sheriff wanted to start smaller within the county, but I think we've proved the concept well enough to ask others to participate. So. In fact, we're planning in the spring. We don't have a date yet.
No date.
Go ahead.
In addition to the two ways that I talked about from an operational standpoint in terms of engagement, there's also a couple of other ways to receive information or to provide input to us. And the first, we're looking at a March date, and I'll be in contact again as soon as that's solidified, to do, and we'll plan on a quarterly update to our elected officials and also our tribal leaders in the community, so that you'll get a more in-depth breakdown on where we are with our goals and objectives, and then the opportunity again to provide input. And then another way that you can support this work is we do have a draft that we brought with us tonight in terms of a resolution that cities can pass just in support of the MAC group and not in the way binding you to providing resources, whether it's human capital or dollars.
Great.
Any other questions? Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Yeah, it's hope you will participate. Beauty of this also is that the organizational structure, as I said, is one that was developed by FEMA. Everybody's familiar with it. We didn't have to argue about structure and who's doing what, and came together. So that eliminated some of the discussions, lengthy discussions about organization. On the goals and objectives, that was an interesting process. Some of us want very aspirational goals, and others want to make sure that we're doing something that's achievable. That will be an ongoing discussion as we go along. And I think some of the hot issues in the county, like needle exchanges and safe injection sites, some that are happening ad hoc, this potentially could create a forum where we can talk about those issues amongst ourselves within the county. And we haven't attempted that or gone down that road yet. Having a policy group of city city officials, elected officials, to talk about those countywide, I think could be beneficial. So, I want to move on and briefly touch on another issue, growth management. As you know, the county is continuing to experience extremely rapid growth. We're growing about 10,000 people a year countywide, so 200,000 people in the next 20 years, roughly. In fact, it's actually trending above that. The county is a keeper of the countywide comprehensive plan, as you know, works with the cities then on their city comprehensive plans, fits it into that overall framework. The county just passed its comprehensive plan just about 2-3 years ago. It wasn't very long ago. But the growth is happening quickly enough that I thought it would be good to start to think about the next iteration. In fact, we have some areas in the county now that have already exceeded what our plan targets were for those areas. And so it's a good time, I think, to step back and have a countywide discussion about what we're going to do with future growth. What do we want the county to look like? And so I'm convening Thursday, February 15th. Invitations should have gone out. We also have an electronic invitation. It would be the evening session from 5:30 to 8 at the warehouse room in the Everett Transit Center. And we're going to present a broad overview of the growth we're experiencing, the growth we anticipate, an overview of the opportunities, options, and limitations within the county. We have areas like floodplains, forest areas, natural areas, and we have our cities. We have unincorporated urban growth areas. And we've got to figure out a strategy to plan for the next, the growth that's continuing to come at us. And I think having the cities and the county together to start to discuss those issues and also engage Snohomish County tomorrow, which is our joint planning organization, and those discussions. I want to kick that off. The intent of the meeting also is to kind of inform newly electeds that might be new to this issue about some of the challenges we're facing. So I hope you will all attend. It'll be painless, it'll be fun, they tell me. And the meeting will be, not managing the growth. But again, that's February 15th, and make sure you get the flyers. Also, just briefly, before I turn it over to Tom, transportation, Councilman Lowe warned me that 5:22 would be asked by somebody, and we continue the county to prioritize, you know, completion of 5:22 as well as Highway 2, trestle capacity growth on Highway 2, with 5:22 working with the state and with the city to get the flexible money we need to do the designs, and we're also pushing as top of our priority at the county to get the additional funding to finish that road off. So I don't have much more to say about that, except that it is on our mind, it's on our priority list, and we, you know, I think have a good working relationship with the city and between the city and county and WashDOT, and the legislators are very aware that this is a high priority for us. So I'm going to want to turn it over now to talk about the parks projects to Tom Titan, and then we can take questions.
Yeah, so Tom Titan, I'm the Snohomish County Parks, Recreation, Tourism Department Director, and that name has changed recently. One of the things that the Executive Summers came into office was really look at the alignment of services, the alignment of departments, and kind of getting the most out of the human resources you have. And that's what they're doing on the opioid crisis and really breaking down silos. And so that's something we've been working on now. And so a number of changes have occurred in the Parks Department. Now we have all of the tourism reporting in through County Parks. And that's a great alignment there. We also have Extension Services is back in County Parks. That was there for about 30 years, moved out for about 12, and now is back in. So that's 4-H and your Master Gardeners and WCU programs. All of that's now aligned. And additionally, Historic Preservation and the Arts Commission. So all of that now resides in Parks. And we're finding, well, like with the Tourism Bureau, connectivity with it. They're a 501c6 that's out there. They work with all the 19 cities and towns. They're all really talking about tourism and pushing that you know, the outdoor rec and kind of a lot of branding with different communities like Monroe and where things are going. And we're finding that getting them tied more closely in alignment with the county, more with our kind of corporate culture. We're very entrepreneurial in the parks. And so they, in fact, are moving in with us at the end of this week, saving $60,000 on a lease payment at a strip mall and moving into Willis Tucker. And that happens on Thursday and Friday. Everybody's excited. It's no problem squishing 10 more people into an already tight building. It's been an adventure. But we have a number of projects in your town or in your city and up and down the valley. We have a 12,000-acre park system. We get about 5 million visitors a year. We have 110 park sites. We do have the highest cost recovery of any park system in the nation, so that's good news for us county citizens. We use about $10 million of general fund to manage that system. And this last year, we're going to make back about $8.3 million. The fairgrounds is obviously a key component of that. That is our most enterprising facility. The good news on that facility is that any and all funds that are made in excess of what it costs stay here. And that's by county code. That code, county code was created in 1997. So the fairgrounds this year, in 2017, operated probably about $880,000 surplus. That all stays on site, and that's what we use to do additional build-outs and additional investment capital facilities at the fairgrounds. So we have a number of key projects that are kind of in the pipeline right now, and I just wanted to give you a Q&A real fast if there's a project that you're wondering about and we didn't talk about. First is the Minota-Snohomish Trail, the regional trail. That's a connection. We've been calling it for many years the Centennial Trail East Extension. We're kind of rethinking that and kind of working on that because the Centennial Trail is going to extend from Skagit County line at the Nakashima Barn down to Woodinville. And that's the Centennial Trail, 42 miles. It's one of the biggest regional trails here and in the state. So this the east-west connection coming from Snohomish over to Monroe and then Monroe down to Duval, we're looking at still naming it. I think the Monroe to Duval section that we're working with you on is going to be the Snoqualmie Valley Trail. And that connects in directly to the King County Regional Trail System. So we want the connection from literally I-90 and all the way up into Monroe, kind of the hub of a lot of activity. So we did dedicate $250,000 in the capital budget to that. That is for design engineering work on the two big bridge crossings. We have bridge and creek crossings. And then we're hoping to leverage those dollars with some additional grant dollars this year going down to RCO. In the 11 years I've been here, we actually just looked this up today, and so we've leveraged about 1-to-1 on our capital program with RCO. I think we've done about $15.8 million in match over $17 million that we've invested in 11 years. So we do really well on grants, so we're going to continue that. And we love getting letters of support, so we've done that routinely for each other, the City of Monroe and County Parks, so we're going to keep doing that. One of those grants that we supported and that Monroe got was actually to study the WASDOT right-of-way in front of the fairgrounds from Cascade View Drive down to 179th and beyond. There's been a lot of interest here locally in some type of pedestrian trail, realigning a bit of the front of the fairgrounds, getting a different look, more aesthetically pleasing, right on US 2. And so I know the city did receive a grant for planning on that. And did talk to WASDOT last week at the governor's office, and so we are meeting with WASDOT again here in about 3 weeks, and this year we'll be implementing a signage plan which will route people through the fairgrounds more effectively and get them off of Highway 2, and then the hope is by 2019 through 2021 to go ahead and do that realignment. And so we'd be moving our fence in. It causes some trauma and drama in the fairgrounds, I will tell you, because we have a fair board and about 90 superintendents that park along that fence line all through the 12-day fair. So aligning that differently. Yeah, 1 minute.
Yeah, no.
Oh, and an executive. Well, I'll always find you a way to get in there.
I didn't know about this.
Yeah, it's all in the works. So it's it's something that's been brewing for a while, and when we're working with Monroe on it. So that's exciting to kind of see that kind of coming to fruition. So it's a grant program we're supporting each other on. Now, there's also most likely going to be a Conservation Futures funding round. So we know that we've reached out to the 19 cities and towns. Monroe is one of the cities that is looking to bring forth potential proposals, looking for help with acquisitions in the area. So if that occurs, it'll be a very competitive process. But I've worked with your city administrator for a number of years now, both in Fulton and Stanwood and now here. She's very persuasive and does a good job on those applications. So we expect them to be competitive at the very least. Additionally, Fairfield County Park, right here on Fireland Boulevard, finally finishing up the driveway improvements and the entry improvements. So it's nice. You guys did a great job in your apron. We've gotten our culvert piece in. That's gone in. It's been rolled out now. I think that frontage piece gets paved a little more, but that'll be nice for going into soccer season and all that this next year. Mike Farrell's not here tonight, but I wanted to call him out. He has been a tremendous asset for the city for many years, but also for the county and in a lot of very key co-planning processes. And one of those is our river towns and trails that we're working on, studied our tourism. And we've been doing that for 2 years, really talking about the potential of how we better interact and how we build sustainable tourism on our trails, on our river systems, in our towns, and connect the knots between those things. Tourism, outdoor rec, and that kind of all combined is about a $2.8 billion industry in Snohomish County every year. So it is big business. It is an economic driver. So better coordinating with our cities and towns, better coordinating these valleys, the Skykomish and Homish Valley, and all the way out to the Salish Sea is a huge focus. They'll be seeing our staff out here this year, the tourism staff, talking about destination and product development and what that does in a regional focus. So they're rolling those out here in the coming months. We'll most likely will come out here and do a presentation to your council on that. I think they've got plans to do that, and all of the 10 city LTAC committees as well. So you'll be seeing that. And then quickly, right now, we've got monthly meetings going on between the fairgrounds, like our key marketing folks and your team here in Monroe, and that's been really great. That's been really a good opportunity for us to talk about branding, to talk about connectivity. Again, continue breaking down silos, continue looking at efficiencies and operation of what we do, what the city does, how those things commingle. And so that's gone great. And then just a quick other factoid, the fairgrounds last year did just over 1,100 events. About 400 of those were large pay-for events, and then the fair itself is the biggest event we host in the county. It was 352,000 folks that came out last year. And we actually count people. I do want to clarify that there are many other fairs in the state, which will remain unnamed here, that actually don't really count people. They don't do e-ticketing for all the gates. They don't. So that's a legitimate, actual, true number. And that stresses everybody. It stresses the city. It stresses our county park system and US 2. But we really appreciate your partnership on that. It's a very important economic driver. And we're still driving about 73% of our revenue during those 12 days at the fairgrounds. So with that being about a $5 million enterprise, you can see it's a significant event. So are there any questions? There's a number of other projects we're working on together, but I promised Dave I wouldn't go on for more than about 10 minutes. I think I've hit that. Any burning questions?
Thank you, Mr. Tigan. Yes, there are. Perfect. Member Cutterback.
Thank you. So the rivers, towns, and trails, I love that. So I'm so glad that we're moving forward with that and spending time on that. And any access point we can get to the river and promote tourism that way, I think is smart. So I appreciate that. Centennial Trail. I appreciate the $250,000 that's been allotted to that. My one question is, that's for design of, I think you said, the two bridges that cross over, I think. Was it French Creek or?
Yeah, French Creek, and then
there's another one. There's a wetland.
Comes through, yeah.
Area.
Yeah.
So allotting that for design is, what's the timeline? Like, what do you perceive as the timeline to really completing that?
Completing the whole trail and getting it done.
Yeah.
Literally getting it paved, or at least graveled at first.
Graveled, paved.
You're still multiple years out. Right now, the average cost for a mile of trail is about $1.2 million. Yeah, $1.2 million now, today's dollars. And quite honestly, a lot of that particular trail has mitigation costs because you're in a lot of wet areas.
Right.
And then the crossings themselves typically are far more than the river crossings, the bridges that you're bringing in, they add to that cost too.
So I asked this question to Mike because he brought that up. In designing when you don't know when you're going to build, is there any thought that those designs would be relevant if it takes 20 years then to build it? And do we waste money designing stuff now for something that we don't know when will be completed and might be out of date by the time we get there?
That's true on some types of projects, generally not trail projects. You have pretty known commodities around your bridges and what that is and your critical areas, and those have all been redefined pretty well in the last decade. So we're very comfortable with those. And trails, I would say, you generally are able to build what you've designed and engineered.
Okay.
Mitigation is a significant cost on most of these trail systems because they're either along rivers, they're along creeks, they're, you know. And there's nothing simple left in the trail system to do.
Yeah.
All the little bit easier projects are done. So what we're doing now is tougher linkages. And
what I hope is that we've been talking about that extension for a long time.
Mm-hmm.
And I know there's other, you know, extending the trail to Woodville has become the priority. So I just hope that the county would recognize and know that we've been talking about this trail for a long time. There are a lot of interested residents and people out in this area that would love that trail to be extended. So I just want to persuade or put that push in there. And then the fairgrounds, I attended, I think, a county meeting where it was talked about kind of renovation, the capital plan, mm-hmm. and what that looked like. So where are you at in that process?
So we've done, in my tenure, we did in 2009, we did a redevelopment initiative, which really talked to about $60 million worth of investment we'd love to see out there. Kind of the renovation of multiple buildings and large-scale buildings, and then going to more of the 24 to 34,000 square foot buildings that are multi-use.
Mm-hmm.
So you certainly during the 12-day fair, you can house animals, you can do a lot of different things. But then the rest of the year, they really do become very viable for, you know, everything from corporate gatherings to sporting events to, trade shows, you know, those kind of things. The Weichel building's done exactly what we hoped for. That's 33,000 square feet. We competed nationally for stimulus funds to do that, and by the 80 acres of commercial next door that picked that up, and that's inside the city limits. So what our plan is right now is we did that in 2009. In 2012, Executive Summers, as a council member, dedicated $100,000 to do additional master planning process that we did through 12 of us council in 2013. And off of that now, what we're doing is refining those spots about two or three buildings. And we're currently doing a contract with an architectural firm now, an on-call firm, to look at the two buildings we want to do next. And one would be a 24,000 square foot building, and one would be 30. And they would be taking out the commercial building, which really has a number of problems, and is a metal-roofed, uninsulated building, so it's kind of the least quality product we have on the grounds now, so that really needs to go. And then combining some of our other 4-H and ag buildings into one larger building. The fair is now, I think, in the 110th year. It's been on that location since 1947. So any change you make to the fairgrounds is traumatic for folks. As Dave will attest to, because, you know, when we changed people, we tore down the dog barn and people thought, it's never coming back, you've right. ruined the dogs, and, you know, now they're the nicest building on the fairgrounds, but we want to keep making those adjustments, so we're hoping over the course of the next 5 years to do both our own reinvestment. Again, we're making about $800,000 a year, and we've done a lot of the less visible work in the last 4 years. Really important things to the city, like basically making sure that if we have a problem with our water on the grounds, it doesn't affect the city's water. So we've done all of our backflow regulating systems. Not a lot of big underground stuff has happened. Lots of power improvements, lots of drainage improvements. And so we've put, I think in the last 11 years that I've been here, I think about $19 million into the fairgrounds. And so it's been a pretty significant spend. But we're really hoping now we're kind of over the hump on those in-ground things that we can move forward with couple of key buildings. And the hope would be that in 2019-2020, we'd see that next building being built.
Anything further, Council? Executive Summers, I really appreciate you coming this evening, and Councilmember Hanford has something to say.
Sorry, I didn't know if you were done.
No, I'm pretty much done. I just wanted to mention there's a commercial air service coming to Banfield in the fall. So the last airlines all up and down the West Coast, San Diego, L.A., San Jose, Seattle, San Francisco, United Airlines to San Francisco and Denver. They're two big hubs, and we're very excited about that. And the terminal is being constructed, and there's some additional FAA work going on, but we're hopeful that that'll open up in the fall. So that's all I wanted to say.
Thank you. We do have a couple of lights. Councilmember Hanford, you still have the floor.
Thank you. Yeah, I wanted to thank you, Executive Summers, for coming and for your leadership, and it's great to see the collaboration going on. The two questions I have for you, are there any plans for rail or to somehow utilize rail going down from the north to the south end of Snohomish County, as well as it was brought up about creating a stop, an Amtrak stop here in Monroe for the trains heading east. Do you know anything about that?
So as you know, the county did acquire the rail right-of-way and line between Snohomish and the county border. It was my hope, actually, when we got into this, that we might grow that eventually into extension from Everett. There used to be a line from Everett to Snohomish and then down south along the east side all the way to Renton. Unfortunately, in King County, Kirkland pulled up their rails, and it seems the King County government is committed to pulling up all the rails and doing trails. And I've spoken with Executive Constantine a number of times. They're pretty much, once you pull rails up and folks get, you know, walking and biking on it, they're kind of gone. So we've been, supporting the limited freight service there. I would like to keep that going down into Woodinville and maybe a dinner train type of thing. But it just looks like, at this point in time, things are not aligned to really use that for passenger rail at any time. It was my hope we could do that, but with King County having their portion blocked off. And they took out the Wilburton tunnel, too. That was a big deal when they took that out of four. But in terms of Amtrak, I honestly don't know. That's not the feasibility of that. I'll look into it. But, I think, as we go into the future, I think those kinds of options are going to be more and more desirable, given the time frames we're talking about for real capacity increase on Highway 2 and other highways. I'd be happy to look into it and support that kind of thing. I think that'd be great. I grew up in a railroad family. My grandfather worked for the railroad and traveled everywhere as a kid that way, all over the world. And it's a great way to travel. So, I'll look into it.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Anything further, Councilmember Hanford? Councilmember Gamble?
No, I'm glad you brought up the Payne Field service. That's a big thank you. I know we passed
resolution.
A resolution in support. And some of us attended different things, and it was a really neat day to see that announcement come through. So really appreciate that, and appreciate you coming out tonight.
Thank you. The terminal is going to be really nice. So it's two gates, but it's going to be very stone
and brick windows. Look at some of the design features.
Very neat. Yeah, very nice. So,
okay. Anything for the council?
Thank you.
Thank you for coming out.
Executive Summers, just a couple things. One, thank you very much for the work that you and your staff are doing, coordinating with our staff. One of the things that, I've lived here since 2000, that I've felt is that our fairgrounds, even though it's part of our community, it feels like a silo, like it's not quite part of our community. And it's got the chain link fence and the green slats going through there. There's no walkway in front, and I look forward to helping make it feel physically more connected to our community. And I appreciate that while it's going to take away from parking and whatnot, you can park at my house if you like. We've got a bike. Having that sort of collaboration, both in terms of the physical nature of the fairgrounds and also the programming, our staffs getting together on a monthly basis, so that the council and the is more aware of what's going on, and we can do cross-pollination of advertising on Facebook and whatnot, I think will be a benefit to our community. I appreciate the work you're doing with connecting the trail from Snohomish to Monroe. As Councilmember Cutaback pointed out, other council members have pointed out too, that's a very important connection for us. 522 is very important for us. I know you're aware of that. One of the concerns that I have is sprawl, and cities to me are properly suited to provide law enforcement. We have three officers on duty at 2 a.m. in the morning, and during the day, Monday through Friday, we've got a lot more staff here, and I feel that we should be encouraging growth within city limits, and that there should be fewer barriers to our ability to annex areas in our urban growth areas, because we do provide services to people in higher density, and I think more efficiently than a county can. So to make that work, we need things like 522 improved, and so I appreciate your support in helping us do that.
Well, I believe in everything you just said, and a little bit of history since the county started doing comprehensive plans. We do have large areas of urban area that are in the county. We don't do as good a job, I'll admit it. We don't have the tax base, we don't have the service levels that cities can provide, and so working with the cities to really, it shouldn't be in your control. So anything I can do to help in that, love to. And in terms of partnering, silos grow up over time and they're hard to break down, but the fair is huge for county government, for county residents, but I know it's a huge presence here and impact on the city. So anything I can do to build that partnership, and if we can make that frontage friendlier to the city and people, it's better for us too, even if I lose a parking spot at all.
It is. Yeah. We actually had a resident here last week talking about being able to walk in front of the fairgrounds. Rosie Cable.
Rosie, I knew who you were talking about.
She was very happy that we were putting sidewalks across the railroad tracks, and so she thanked us for that, and then she lamented about the crossing.
Yes,
the fairgrounds here. So I won't take much more of your time. Again, thank you very much, and to the directors and Alessandra that were here tonight. Also thank them for coming.
Thank you.
Yeah, thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. Our next item on the agenda is public comment. This is a time set aside for members of the audience to speak to the City Council on any issue related to the City of Monroe, except any quasi-judicial matter that is subject to a public hearing. Ms. Atkinson will bring in a sign-up sheet. Do we have anybody who's signed up?
Yes, we do.
Heidi Ferguson. Ms. Ferguson, please come forward and state your name and address for the record, and welcome.
I'm really nervous. Hi, I'm Heidi Ferguson. I live at 700 West Maple Street here in Monroe. And I would like some crosswalks up and down Kelsey, particularly. On December 15th, my daughter Ashley was hit by a car walking home from school right at Kelsey and Columbia. And it occurred to me that there's no crosswalk there. And I know that at the beginning of every year, we've got your take the kids to, or walk your kids to school day. Yeah. And we beat it into their heads that cross at a crosswalk. It never occurred to me to tell her what to do when there's not one visible. So I'm hoping that at least in the higher populated or walking areas around Frank Wagner or the schools, that we can get some crosswalks painted so that everyone, drivers and kids, all know what's there and who's coming.
Thank you very much.
Okay.
Did great.
Yes. Is there anybody else who would like to come forward to speak to the council this evening? Anybody at all? Okay, we are now going to go to final action number one. This is AB 18-019, authorize mayor to sign police guild collective bargaining agreement. We've got Chief Quinzer here to present.
Thank you, Mr. Mayor. The City of Monroe is the police officers guild that participated in collective bargaining negotiations and have reached a tentative agreement for a 3-year contract pending the City Council approval. The collective bargaining agreement has been ratified already by the Monroe Police Officers Guild. I would like to add that there's been one small change that the guild has already approved and that will be put into the contract after tonight, and that is the addition of a Kaiser Permanente a PPO medical plan. This change will allow the officers to select from two plans, a PPO plan and a high deductible health plan. Allowing the PPO option will ensure officers can keep their existing providers. The additional plan, this is the most important, will not result in an increase to the cost of the city.
Thank you. Councilmember Hanford.
Thank you. I move to authorize Mayor to sign.
Councilmember Hanford, just a second. Okay, do we need, I'm sorry, Councilmember Hanford.
Sure.
Reading in the motion as presented in Agenda Bill number 18-019 will take care of the PPO issue you just discussed.
I don't think it's in there at this time.
I think the issue for staff was whether or not the council considered this to be a minor revision, because it is an addition to the plan, but if that's your perspective, we're fine with you reading that motion as long as it's clear.
Okay, so Councilmember Hanford, you have the floor. Councilmember Camp, do you have a question?
I have a question. So,
do you mind yielding the floor for a moment?
I will yield.
Okay, Councilmember
Camp. I just want to make sure, in terms of minor revisions as deemed necessary, you said that there is no monetary impact to the city?
No increased cost to the city.
Okay. Then that sounds like a minor revision.
Yeah, me too.
Thank you. I'm going to go ahead and give the floor back to Councilmember Hanford. Councilmember Hanford.
Thank you. To answer your question, I believe that to be a minor revision as well.
Okay, thank
you. So I move to authorize the mayor to sign the collective bargaining agreement with the Monroe Police Officers Guild and authorize further minor revisions as deemed necessary or appropriate.
Second.
I have a first from Councilmember Hanford, a motion from Councilmember Hanford, a second from Councilmember Gamble for the requested action as identified in Agenda Bill number 18-019. Any discussion on the motion? Seeing none, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed? Motion passes 7-0. Thank you, everybody. Thank you, Chief.
Thank you.
Thank you.
So we're going to go ahead and move to the next item on the agenda. This is Mayor and Administrative Reports. Before we get into that, Chief Quinzer did place something at everybody's position that I'd like Chief Quinzer to go ahead and point out. So while the department reports aren't on, I'd like to go through that. Chief Quinzer.
Yes. Earlier this week, we got this thank you note from this young lady. And the mayor and I were discussing it, and we thought you all might be interested in seeing something like this. We have successes, and the most important thing here, I believe she says at the bottom, I can't read it, it's on the right-hand side, right above her new car, but that's
not all of us are hopeless.
Not all of us are hopeless. And I listened to the presentation by the county tonight, and I can tell you positively that the success rates in the city of Monroe far exceed what it is in the county. This program that we have going on right now is working. So, thank you.
Thank you, Chief.
This is great.
So let's go ahead and move back up here to City Administrator and Legislative Update. Ms. Knight.
So a couple of items. we, Mike Farrell and myself, met with Cadman and had a really productive meeting going over the draft master plan and talking about next steps to finish the reclamation process and then eventually turn the property over to the city. So I'm very excited to move this project forward, and it looks like if everything works out as it should, we may be talking about that property transfer sometime in the middle to late next year. So I think that's really exciting news for us. We did receive 3 proposals for our business recruitment, retention, and expansion request for proposal, and we'll be doing those interviews on February 2nd. So again, moving this forward to the City Council for consideration at your meetings in February. So also looking forward to getting this off the ground and moving forward. On a legislative update, if you hadn't already heard, the governor signed the capital budget, which meant that that released up the $800,000 in the budget for the Lake Tye multi-purpose field, or all-weather field. Looking forward to getting that project started. I think you all recognize that's not all of the money we need, so we're still going to be looking forward. We've got some money in the city's budget to continue the design, but it is a step in the right direction, and we'll be asking for additional money when we're down in Olympia tomorrow and Thursday. On that note, we are going to be testifying at a hearing first thing tomorrow morning at 8 in favor of some legislation that the city is moving forward with to allow voters to approve de-annexation from a park and recreation district. So again, just looking for flexibility and tools in the toolbox around park funding. So we're going to be testifying for that tomorrow morning. We're also, as the city, hosting members, elected representatives from the 39th legislative district. So other cities will be joining us for dinner. They're paying their own way. We're paying our own way. It's a Dutch Street situation. But we are having our own legislators will be there. We've got 21 people who've RSVP'd for that dinner, including the
7 whole people from council and Sultan.
So
and
we need our council.
New mayor.
Yes. Yeah, so that'll be a great opportunity to share information and then kind of move again a regional agenda forward around US 2, SR 522, these trail connections that we've been talking about. So I think that'll be very nice. Council members, Cutback and Scarborough are going to be with us on Wednesday and Thursday.
And just to fill in a little bit more about that, so we will be, as Ms. Knight pointed out, providing testimony tomorrow morning at 8. We'll be meeting with Representative Eslick at 7:30 tomorrow morning, if I remember correctly. We will then have a meeting Wednesday with Representative Christensen, Representative Eslick, and Senator Wagner. All of that is occurring tomorrow while the conference is simultaneously going on. We're also meeting with somebody from the Parks and Recreation Association to talk about adding tools to the toolbox relative to the Parks District being able to de-annex or modify the district boundaries. And then on Thursday, a couple of us have registered to take part in a growth management exercise from 11 a.m. until like 2:30 p.m. And so I don't know if Councilmember Scarborough and Cutaback will be joining us, but
11:32. Yes.
Okay.
Wednesday.
Yes, and
yeah, we'll be there.
Thursday.
Whatever you want me to do.
Excellent. Thank you. So we will have a very full agenda while we're down there, right into tomorrow night. And thank you and staff for organizing all of that. I really appreciate that. Did you have anything further? Because I don't know if that
matters. Nothing other than what you see on the extended agenda. And I won't go into it because time's getting late.
Just a couple things for me. Last week, Snohomish County Cities, I'll be continuing on PSRC's Economic Development District. Second, I'll be serving as second alternate on the Puget Sound Regional Council's Growth Management Policy Board, and then I will be serving as the first alternate for Community Transit. Councilmember Scarborough and Cutaback weren't able to make it, so I'll be serving as the first alternate. And I think that's pretty much all that I had to share right now. Councilmember Cutaback?
Just a question in the legislative report about the Metropolitan Park District. Mm-hmm. On council, we kind of briefly looked at that a long time ago when I was first on council and had that discussion. That's first I'm hearing that we as a city are kind of looking at that possibly again. is the P4 going to take a crack at that and look at that? I know the hearing tomorrow is just kind of a first step to be able to get that passed so we can annex ourselves from the East. Was it the East County? No, what is it? What's the district?
East County Park and Rec District.
Yes, but so moving forward, is the P4 going to maybe take a look at that and bring it back?
They actually looked at it this evening.
Oh, they did.
And the Finance Committee also looked at it.
Okay.
So we received direction from both of those committees to reach out to start a conversation with the East County Park and Rec District to see whether or not we can use that existing vehicle that's already in place, both for the district's perspective and from the county and from the city's perspective.
Okay,
so we're kind of a three-way partnership working on that.
And I was remiss to share on January 11th, we did get a letter from Snohomish County Public Works. I'll go ahead and read it. The Snohomish County Solid Waste Advisory Committee is comprised of a countywide group of representatives. And I'm going to skip down. Each of the counties, so each signatory to the county's Comprehensive Solid Waste Management Plan can nominate a member. We are able to nominate a member who will be appointed by the county council for a two-year term. So they're looking to see if there's anybody on our council that would like to serve as part of this Solid Waste Advisory Committee. And Ms. Knight, can you share a little bit more information on it? And I'll pass this down.
It's a pretty minor commitment. They're supposed to meet monthly or quarterly, and in my experience, they pretty much cancel all but two meetings a year. But it is important from the perspective of the big picture solid waste efforts that go on throughout the county. So the opening and closing of solid waste transfer stations, for example, is something that the county works with this committee on. They also work with the county or with the committee on the solid waste comprehensive plan. So where does the city's solid waste and the county solid waste go? So if that's something that's of interest to you, you can let somebody, myself or Elizabeth, know, and we can work to get you appointed to that committee.
All right, I think that's all that I had. We don't have a need for an executive session, and we are now going to move down to the table for the two discussion items. So we will recess for about... there are two lights. Councilmember Camp and then Councilmember Rasmussen. Councilmember Camp.
Thank you. I mentioned February 13th, the Cub Scouts would like to do their flag presentation, and... I haven't heard anything back.
Oh,
I'd like
you're
to get
back
to
Yes, you're scheduled for the 13th.
Okay, that's all I can
think. I apologize, I thought we had communicated back to you.
One other question. So I know we've lost Duke. Can we still have a police tour?
Yeah, yeah. Certainly.
Okay, so
I think I sent you an email on it.
I don't, well, I haven't been able to get my email and password, it's fine.
Yes,
but I'll inform them that it is the 13th. I'll see what your email says.
And includes the tour.
Okay.
6 o'clock.
6 o'clock. Right. All right. Thank you.
Thank you. Councilmember Rasmussen.
Give a quick P4 committee update.
We can update that next week. That works for you?
Sure.
Did we want to update? You can go ahead and give an update. Yeah, I think what we wanted to do was when the minutes come up, go ahead and update it the next week once that minutes are in the packet. But okay, if that works, we'll go ahead and do that.
I just won't be here next week, so
oh, we'll then give a report.
Go ahead and give a report. Time.
Okay. All right. So the next item that we have on the agenda will be down for discussion items 1 and 2. We'll go ahead and recess for about 2 minutes. Thank you. All right, council members, let's go ahead and reconvene. We are now going into our discussion portion of this agenda. And the first item that we have for presentation is the local elected officials guide to disasters. Speaking of disasters,
I was going I've woken up at 3:30. I was going to introduce Jason Bierman, the HERA guy I introduced to you earlier. The previous presentation, but Jason is the director of the Department of Emergency Management in Snohomish County. And as you may be aware, we have a contract with Snohomish County for them to assist us with our emergency preparedness and emergency management functions. And so we will begin to talk today about what the role and responsibilities of the elected officials are, and then also some general guidance of what the city is supposed to be doing. So,
okay, Jason.
Okay.
Thanks, Brad. And I understand that we're going to cut this in about half, so I'm going to move fairly briskly. But if you have any questions, please feel free to stop me. This is not going to be ICS training, so this really is focused on, this is something I developed a few years ago. This is really talking about elected officials and what your role is before, during, and after a disaster. I'm gonna speak somewhat in generalities because I give this presentation to the cities all around the county. Brad's gonna fill in some of the minute details, and he's ready for that, obviously. But essentially, we're gonna go through this with the idea that when you come out of this, like I mentioned, have a better sense of what your roles and responsibilities are as elected officials before, during, and after. What a policy group might look like. Dave mentioned the policy group we're talking about putting together in order to get policy level feedback on the opioid response. It's something we would be doing if we had a large scale widespread disaster as well. So some of the similarities in what we're doing with the opioid response may mirror what we would do with any other disaster. So that's just something to keep in mind. And then if we have time, and I understand that we may not, but if you have questions, I can give you some examples of policy decisions that you might have to make in certain phases of a disaster. But if we don't have time, I'll either come back or Brad will make them for you. Okay, so going into the overview, or help you make them. Going into the overview, it's important for you to know all disasters are local. You will hear that from the federal level, you'll hear it from the state level. They truly are local events. No matter if it's just in Monroe, if it affects all or a significant part of the county, all disasters are considered local events. The current FEMA administrator talks about how the federal government supports them, states help implement some of the strategies, but the actual execution takes place at the local level. So where you fit into this is that leadership and policy guidance. And I'm going to talk again in terms of strategic leadership and policy guidance versus tactical leadership and policy guidance. You really work at a level above where your first responders are. Your fire chief, your police chief, your public works director, the assets that are actually out in the field, they work generally every day doing things very similar to what they'll do during a disaster. Maybe not in the same stressful or time-compressed environment, but they're doing this stuff day after day. They're responding to fires, they're responding to public works issues. Your space in this is really staying at the strategic and policy level and helping support them as they do the tactical work. So breaking this down, what it looks like before, during, and after. So one of the things that you can do as elected officials before is make planning a priority. There's a lot of disaster-related planning going on. I mentioned in the earlier discussion we had, there's a state law-mandated comprehensive emergency management plan, but there are a lot of planning pieces that go along with that, from disaster debris management planning, which is something you're just talking about solid waste in that community, to how you're handling evacuation of residents, how you're handling sheltering of animals. I mean, there are literally dozens of plans that we're working on that all fold into that comprehensive strategy that we call a comprehensive emergency management plan. Those things don't get done unless it's a priority for you. I know one of the things that Dave has us, that we're about to launch and that we're working on, updating and making sure is planning for how we do continuity of operations and continuity of government. How do your departments continue to function when they don't have people and when they don't have any facilities? If buildings go down, and they can do that for a variety of reasons, if you don't have people, again, for a variety of reasons, ranging from large earthquake to some sort of flu epidemic, those are planning processes that you really want to make a priority, because those are the things that will keep your departments functioning. And in terms of continuity of government, because of where we live and the hazards that we have, which are pretty devastating, how do you keep your government functioning if Again, for example, if our county code says that there are a certain number of council members who must be present to affect change, what if they actually literally can't get there? How do we amend code to ensure that we can still make decisions and do things? And the same thing at the city, town, and tribal levels as well. Know what the hazards are. Your city participates in our multi-jurisdictional hazard mitigation plan. That's a succinct 1,500-page read. There's an executive summary. It's a very detailed 1,500-page read, about half of which is a very deep analysis of our hazards, our natural hazards that affect us. Have an understanding, again, not necessarily at a granular level, but have a general understanding of what the impacts are to your community in terms of how bad is. Most people, and certainly there was a lot of news generated around the Cascadia subduction zone a couple of years ago when we did a large exercise based on that scenario, and that is devastating. But we have a crustal fault line that runs very near here, the South Whidbey Island fault line, that to this county, at least on the modeling we've done, is more destructive in terms of direct damage than Cascadia is. It's about nearly $14 billion in direct damage to infrastructure. So we have a lot of different hazards that affect us. So just be aware of them and how bad is. And then learning about emergency management, which is kind of what you're doing tonight. But beyond that, what the assistance programs are. That's a key role you'll play when we get to the recovery part. As policymakers, understanding what assistance is available, and that includes before, during, and after, but understanding what those programs are, and how you can leverage them when they're available to you, and how you want to think about using them to better some of these other things before a disaster happens. We talked a lot tonight about collaboration. One of the areas where you as policymakers can really help is working with the business community. You want them to be prepared. There are a lot of different statistics out there. Generally, I think most people settle on that if a business doesn't open within a week or so after a disaster, there's about an 85% chance they're never reopening again. So working with them to help them be prepared themselves, to understand that you want them to get back in business. And we're doing a lot of work right now at the county level with the food sector in particular, because there's been a lot of work done in Puerto Rico and how fast the food sector on the private side can upsize their ability to deliver food. It's about 5 times faster than all the federal resources combined can do that. So understanding that they play an integral part, not just as sort of a backup to the government, they in some instances are going to have a lot more to bring to the response and the recovery than we will as a government. So engaging with them. I talked about continuity of operations planning and continuity of government planning. Know where your ECC, EOC, Community Coordination Center, tell me.
Monroe Coordination Center.
Your Monroe Coordination Center, everyone's got a different name. We'll fix that one day. But understanding where your operation center is, who the people that are in there, not necessarily, again, because you're going to go in there and direct the activities, but so that you know where the information hub is for your community. And how you support it, because they'll have a vital role in connecting with us and coordinating efforts that are going to happen here. Some last things, individual preparedness. Every presentation I give usually starts and ends with, that is everybody in our community's responsibility. And in my instance, that's the entire county. None of our plans work, none of the things that we talk about work if people aren't individually prepared. And that's from our responders to the community members at large. So if you don't know, in the lead up to the Cascadia exercise, we did a lot of research on that as well and how long it would take to move large scale commodities in that scenario. And the state has settled on, we used to ask people to be prepared for 72 hours, and now we ask them to be prepared for 2 weeks. And that's a huge lift for some people and unattainable for others. So it's our goal to try and get people moving towards 2 weeks. That's how long in conversations with the military and the military at large, not just the National Guard, but the military, DOD, that's about how long we think it will take them to move large-scale commodities up the coastline from the port of LA Long Beach and start supporting us. Because aircraft, with the 2.5 million people we think we're going to have to either shelter or feed after that earthquake, that's a lot of airplanes, and we're not going to have enough airfields left. So there's a lot of that stuff in bulk is going to come by ship, and it takes a long time. So we want people to be prepared. as elected officials, participate in training exercises. You're doing training right now. We have community level exercises. We're planning a large scale county level exercise in 2019. So being part of that, supporting it, supporting the efforts to make sure that people practice this stuff, is an incredibly important part of this, because that's how we validate all that planning we do. If we write plans and then never test them, when we don't want to find out that they're not workable is when we're in the middle of a response. So that's our opportunity, as I like to tell people, to practice without penalty. And then the last thing, make sure you know what your legal responsibilities and authorities are. That gets a little confusing in terms of who's authorized to proclaim a disaster, who has legal responsibility, who has to do the review. Those are processes that you can work out ahead of time, and it makes it a lot less painful when you're in the middle of a disaster response to deal with it. Speaking of being in the middle of it, so some of the things that you all can do during a disaster response: coordinating with the mayor's office and having coordinated messaging. Again, we talked earlier about how critical it is to coordinate our messaging around the opioid response. And there are a lot of moving parts to the opioid response, but imagine a disaster that affects the entire town. There's going to be lots of moving pieces within your city, in coordination with us, in coordination with the areas around you. So working to make sure that you, one, have a coordinated message, and two, you all are very helpful in getting out into the city and helping making sure that message gets distributed. People are going to come to you. I spent the first week after SR 530 happened in the town of Darrington. And I was in Mayor Rankin's back pocket for most of that week. And we worked very closely with the town council out there to make sure that information was getting out and that we had a way to communicate with the public, because not one of you, the mayor, can't do it all. Your PIO won't be able to do it all. So all of you have a role in making sure that that coordinated message gets out. The situational awareness piece, I certainly, because of what I do and on behalf of Brett, I advocate you get your information as much as you can from your coordination center. You're going to get it from lots of other places too. Social media, if it's available, is going to be exploding. The media itself, TV and radio, is going to be all over the place. As much as you can, validating your information from your coordination center is an important piece, because that's the information that is going to be vetted, that's going to have come from trusted sources. And so while it's very easy and I think sometimes attractive to try and feed off of information that you're getting in quote-unquote real time, it's not always the most reliable. So working closely with them and with the mayor's office to understand that all of you have the same level of awareness of what's going on is an important part of that. And they work hard in the operations center, in our case the coordination center, to make sure we put all of that information, like I said, through a vetting process, so that way it's reliable and you're not putting out information. It may not be what's happened 5 minutes ago, it may be what happened an hour ago, but it's from a trusted source and it's been vetted. The resource request process, I have that on here because that is one thing that, quite frankly, it becomes problematic, because in a disaster response, everybody wants everything and they all want it right now. And that's actually not how it works. And I use SR 530 as kind of, an example. Most people do not know that within about a week after that happened, we were ordering waders, hip waders and chest waders, from as far away as Maine. Because people were screaming, why weren't we just going to Cabela's to get them? We had bought out Cabela's all the way to Maine. There are only so many size 9, 10, and 11 hip waders in the world. Everybody works on just-in-time delivery, and they can only produce them so fast. So when you're trying to outfit 650 people who are out there in the debris pile, and again, this is an incident that was 1 square mile, and some of our hazards will be hundreds and hundreds of square miles, we were buying stuff from as far away as Maine, and that stuff has to get boxed and shipped and delivered and picked up and redistributed. So understand that that doesn't happen as quickly as anybody wants it to. But everything that we're doing is trying to get stuff here as fast as we can, and helping mitigate the understanding of that, because people will be asking for the stuff right now, and it doesn't happen right now. Knowing what your mutual aid options are. Brad's been great about advocating, and we're working through how to make sure that we coordinate all of that at the county level, and from county to county, how we support each other. But understand that as well takes time. SR 530, we brought about 350 different people into our then EOC alone, it takes days for them to realize that, hey, I've got the time to do it, I can get released from my job, I can travel there, I can get set up. None of this stuff happens as quickly as you want it to. So just understand that and help your tactical folks mitigate the concerns and the expectations from the public, which is going to be that you're going to get everything here right now, because that's not reality. Some of the other things you do, supporting your emergency management folks. The Disaster Policy Board is one of the things, again, that was mentioned earlier that I'll mention to you. Having a mechanism where your elected officials can get together and establish policy for your EOC is an important piece of that. They are going to operate within the parameters of what they know, but if you can sit down as policymakers and give them some priorities, and address some of their issues, and again, some of them would be things that we have addressed. What will we do with personal belongings after a large mudslide when people have irreplaceable, invaluable items that we're finding out in the debris field? Do we just toss those away? What do you want us to do with them? We made a policy decision that we would clean them, catalog them. We paid for a facility to put them in where they were we would allow people, family members, survivors to come in and actually get the personal belongings back. So some of those policy decisions you may have to do. Are you going to restrict access to certain areas? Are you going to try and enforce things like curfews? Are you going to make some really hard priority decisions when you don't have enough resources? When you have multiple fires burning in the city, are you going to make a policy decision to say some fires are just going to burn? Because that's a very common thing after an earthquake with gas line breaks and everything else. You may have to make a decision based upon lack of availability of water that some places are just going to burn. So those are some tough decisions and conversations that have to happen. And having a forum set up, and Brad, I don't know if you want to speak to any specifics about how that gets set up.
We're in the process of developing.
Okay, so. Perfect. So, and we will then, in that process of you developing it, we're trying to create linkages from the county level so that there's a forum for the executive to convene a policy board similar to what we're doing with the opioid response, so that we get input from all the cities that are affected as well. That last bullet seems really straightforward, but again, and I kind of have the luxury of speaking from this from the outside, it's very easy for policymakers to want to influence change really quickly because you're going to be under a lot of pressure too. You have to trust that your emergency managers, your responders are doing the right thing with what they have available to them. And that's just an important part of this. They're going to be making tough decisions that are really time-constrained and stressful conditions as well. But trusting and empowering and knowing that they're doing the right thing is a key part of the response. And the response is quite frankly, the easy part in some ways. It's afterwards that things get even more convoluted, and we found this out and lived through this. Disaster response really tends to orient people towards we're saving lives, we're saving property, we're trying to do all the right things to really minimize the impact. Getting into the response piece is when things really get complicated in terms of now people need to be made whole if we can, need to revitalize our community, we need to reestablish some normalcy, all of those things. So know what some of the programs are, and I'll overview some of them, but know what the assistance programs are. Have all of you heard of FEMA Individual Assistance? It's also called the Individual and Households Program. Any of you ever heard of FEMA money for local folks? Right, everybody thinks they get that, right? And everybody thinks that that's a big pot of money. So I think this year, the maximum award under FEMA Individual Assistance was a little over $38,000. So if you lost everything, including a house that was not insured, all FEMA is going to give you at the max award is $38,000. The average payout is less than $5,000. So know that those programs are out there, but they are not folks who have this sort of mental image of Katrina and FEMA handing out credit cards that people could go use, essentially debit cards that they could go use. That's actually not how the program works. So understand what the programs are, what the limitations are, and how you go about getting the money. And understand, again, in terms of expectation management with your community, that that money does not go as far as most people imagine it does. We get that question all the time after floods, where's my FEMA money? One of the things with that program is it's extremely hard to qualify for it. We have, in this county's history, and we've had 11 environmental declarations since 1996. We've qualified for it twice. Once for a very small population after the worst floods in the county's history, and once for SR 530. Other than that, it's extremely tough to qualify for it. There's no set formula under the law. There's a general rule of thumb that there have to be 100 destroyed households. And so that's really tough for folks to qualify. Know that the recovery process is complicated. Know that everyone's going to want to have a say or have input into the process, and have an idea for how you want to implement that. That goes back to the planning part. We worked really hard, luckily, before SR 530 happened, to have a framework for our recovery plan, so we knew who we wanted to invite and where people plugged in before it even happened. And we spent, it was literally on day 8 after that incident when we assigned one person initially and then many, many others to the recovery process. So we were 8 days into what was 37 days of intensive searching and then 4 months till we actually found the last victim. 8 days into that, we were already setting up our recovery process. And that's ongoing. So we're approaching the 4th anniversary. And if Tom was here, he would tell you we're still very much involved in the recovery process in terms of how we memorialize what happened and still, you know, interacting with the families with things like some of you may have seen on the news. We recently took down the memorial tree out there. All of those are extremely painful and emotional things. And those are all things that you as policymakers and elected officials can help the community get through and stay working together. That's an important part of this. Third bullet, most people I talk to, especially people who sort of live in the post-disaster recovery world, many entertain the fantasy that we're going to rebuild much better, much stronger, much different, all those other things. And those are great goals to have, but there will be a lot of pressure just to rebuild, period. After Houston was overwhelmingly flooded with over 50 inches of rain recently, everybody said, hey, when we build back, we need to build back and out of the floodways and all those other things, and then the developers weighed in. And there were literally weeks of discussion about what the post-flood regulations and the rebuilding regulations were going to look like. Think about the opportunities that you can maximize, and think about where things have to get done quickly and figure out how to balance that. And ask questions. All the resources that you hear about, and I will say specifically in this region, from FEMA Region 10 to Washington State's Emergency Management Division to our shop, everybody in this region works together really well and collaboratively in the emergency management world. It's kind of a, I'm with the government, I'm here to help. These folks actually really do care. FEMA Region 10 is in Bothell, it's in our county. Many of those folks live here. They're invested in our community, so they're really here to help out. The state's been a great partner through lots of different incidents here. So asking questions, if you don't know the answer, there are lots of people who will be willing to help. Disaster declarations, this is a bit of an overview. You proclaim disasters here locally, we proclaim them at the county level, the state does the same thing. The federal government actually is the one entity that declares disasters. They're the ones who can actually assign dollars from the federal government. And all that really does, depending on how your legislation or your code is written, is make resources available faster and easier. That's the biggest thing that those declarations and proclamations do. That's how it's done at the state level. Within our state, at the local level, it's typically the mayor, in our case the executive, and generally, again, this is a generalization, in our case at the county level, it allows our comprehensive emergency management plan to go into force, and then it authorizes us to maneuver around some of the typical contracting things to get access to goods and services faster. At the state level, it's the governor. There's a whole host of things that it actually launches from the state level. Be aware that many of these things come with a significant price tag. There's been a lot of, lots of people say, why aren't you just calling the National Guard? They're a very expensive option to come work. Lots of people, again, after SR 530, talked about bringing out the urban search and rescue team. It's $1.5 million to get them in your county, and then they spend, depending on how much you're asking them to do, a couple hundred thousand dollars per day. So these are expensive things that come when you ask them to. But that's what the state proclamation allows. And then, like I said, the president's the one who can actually authorize the use of federal resources. There are some workarounds for that. And again, that's a case where your emergency operations center would work with ours. There is what's called direct federal assistance, so there are some ways that you can work around some of these things, but they're very complicated for a reason. But there are ways that we can help get some access to some of these things, at least for short amounts of time for very specific reasons. I talked about some of the factors that go into when FEMA actually declares a disaster. Those are some of the things that affect it. There's also dollar considerations for public assistance. It's a per capita formula, so that's a bit of a different animal with public assistance. Public assistance is not for the public, it's actually for infrastructure, so people get a little confused about that. Also understand that some of these other programs, and most of these we have used in the county, these are available without a disaster declaration. When there was the microburst, little flooding in downtown Marysville a number of years ago, we got a Small Business Administration disaster declaration, which they can do on their own. So some of these programs we can actually access without going through the long process of getting the president to declare a federal disaster. These are some of just the laws that govern it. I touch on this because we've had extensive conversations, and I was glad Brad pointed out, my department supports your emergency management efforts. We are not, I don't have a pointer, so I'm gonna use the old school one. So there are, in our state, there are local organizations for emergency management, and the law also allows for what's called joint local organizations. A joint local organization is what many people think we are, but under the law, that is something that every participating jurisdiction pays the same amount into and all has control over together in a joint effort. We are a local organization that supports your emergency management through an interlocal agreement. So we don't become legally your emergency management organization, we support the efforts. So within the law, there are some things that every political subdivision sets up its own emergency management program. We work closely with Brad, who's the point of contact we have here, but we don't legally become the emergency management organization for any of the jurisdictions in the county. We support their efforts. That's the federal law that covers most of what I've talked about in terms of the federal programs. Here are a couple of things. There is, if you're really interested in incident command system training, and I know Dave's a big fan of it, you can do some of it online. We host several opportunities per year as well, and we can also bring that here if you have folks that wanted to do it in person. The consortium, I mentioned, because if you're really going to champion being prepared, the consortium is a group of universities, seven different universities that provide classes free of charge, and we coordinate delivering those courses through our office, or we'll work with Brad if you want him to bring, and there's a whole myriad if you want to go to the website. There are dozens of courses available through them, but that's something that we can bring. And these are just some of the federal policy documents that guide overarchingly how all of us in the nation do business. So I spoke as quickly as I could, trying to keep it to the 30 minutes Brad gave me. And with 2 minutes to spare, I'll entertain any questions you have about anything that I went through.
Any questions, Council? Thank you.
All right.
Councilmember Gamble.
Well, it's actually for Brad. You're
okay.
Talking about the development of the Monroe, what was the acronym?
Monroe Coordination Center.
Yes, where is the Monroe Coordination Center?
Well, currently it's in the trailer out back.
Okay.
And in the construction of the new public workshop, the north end of the building will be the new coordination center.
Thanks.
Okay. Any other questions, Council?
Appreciate this.
Thank you very much.
I was going through all the different links as you were talking. So.
Thanks. Thank you very much for coming up.
Yeah, thank you.
We have open invasion heading next.
Okay, so just really quickly as a reminder, this was a House bill that changed laws back in 2013, effective 2014, for Open Government Training Act.
for elected officials and also some public staff officials, public records officers. You had your first round of training back in 2014, and you are required to have a refresher every 4 years. So, ta-da, 2018 is your refresher. So this covers the Sunshine Laws, which include the Open Public Meetings and Open Public Records, and also records retention, which is the rules on how long we need to keep records and how we need to take care of them after they've met their retention. So tonight what we're going to go over is we're going to go through the AG's office training on the OPMA as well as the PRA, and then I'll just kind of give a quick 2-second overview of records retention, and then there is a records retention video that I will go ahead and send you a link, and I'll send you just some helpful links for records retention for elected officials after this meeting, but I won't have you sit through that particular training tonight. So I will start with the any choices on going OPMA PRA first? Anyone? All right, we'll start with Kira. It's the longer one. And we'll see if I can get the volume up.
He's talking, but we're not here.
Yeah.
Oh, it's a good spot for us.
Oh, yeah, I don't want to hear from that.
There's volume on the TV that you need to turn up.
Provide greater understanding of the legal requirements around the tax.
Don't worry, I don't
think you'll find it. Perfect.
The Public Records Act is a law created by an initiative vote of the people in 1972, which provides the public access to the records of government agencies. It received 72% of the vote. The purpose of the Act is to provide the public full access to information concerning the conduct of government, mindful of individuals' privacy rights, and fulfill the desire for the efficient administration of government. The law is based on the principle that open government is essential to a free society. All state and local agencies must comply with the Public Records Act. All public records must be disclosed unless a law exempts records or information. There are well over several hundred exemptions. Some of those exemptions are listed in the Act, but many exist in other state and federal laws. The Act is a broad mandate interpreted in favor of disclosure, and its exemptions are narrowly construed.
This training presentation is based on the Public Records Act and the Attorney General's Advisory Model Rules. The rules are online at the Attorney General's website at www.atg.wa.gov. They provide examples of steps to comply with the Public Records Act. An agency may adopt any part of the model rules into its own rules. Local agencies should consult the model rules when establishing local Public Records Act ordinances. The model rules provide comments that are useful for interpreting the Public Records Act and for training agency personnel. The model rules are non-binding, but they are based on extensive outreach, court decisions, and have been cited favorably in some court cases. This training video was prepared in the fall of 2017. The model rules were being updated in 2017. The legislature also amended the Public Records Act in 2017, and the legislature can amend it again in the future. The courts can also interpret the Act. Consequently, and as a reminder, there may be developments in the law after this video was prepared. Several updates on the law are often posted in materials on the Attorney General's Office website on the Open Government Training page. A PowerPoint on that page also provides training on the Public Records Act. This training video contains 16 short segments where we will review history, purpose, and intent of the Public Records Act, scope of the PRA, general obligations of an agency, what is a public record, requests for records, initial agency responses, reasonable estimates, adequate searches, disclosure, electronic records, managing broad requests, exemptions and withholding, fees, other records provisions, liability, and finally, additional resources. You have just heard from the Attorney General about the history, purpose, and intent of the Act. The Act regulates the disclosure of public records. The Act requires disclosure of public records unless a law permits withholding of a record or part of a record. The Act has many components, and compliance requires training. Training can be the difference between a satisfied requester and expensive litigation. The Act applies to both state and local agencies. A state agency includes every state office, department, division, bureau, board, and commission. A local agency includes every county, city, town, municipal corporation, special purpose district, and other forms of local government. In some cases, an entity which is not an agency can still be subject to the Act when it is the functional equivalent of an agency. This determination depends on whether it performs a government function, receives government funding, the extent of government involvement or regulation, and whether the entity was created by government. Courts are not subject to the Act. Agencies must appoint a public records officer, responsible for being a point of contact for the public and for overseeing compliance. The name and contact information of the public records officer should be published with information on how to submit requests for records. The public records officer must have received training on the Act within 90 days of assuming his or her duties. Agencies must also publish information on the agency organization, rules, and procedures, and an index of specific categories of records. Agencies are required to adopt reasonable rules to provide full public access to public records, to protect public records from damage or disorganization, to prevent excessive interference with other essential functions of the agency, and to provide the fullest assistance to inquirers. Agencies may wish to consult with their attorneys when developing their rules and procedures. A public record is any writing relating to the conduct of government which is prepared, owned, used, or retained by any state or local agency, regardless of physical form or characteristics. It could be an email, text message, paper, letter, or memo, an audio or video recording, a picture, image, map, or any recording of information or data compilation from which information may be obtained or translated. A public record is not just what an agency creates, but includes documents created by citizens or private companies that are used or received by a government for a governmental purpose. A public record may also include documents not possessed by the agency, but which were used by the agency. For example, the courts have described that work documents on the personal computer, personal cell phone, or personal email account of an agency employee or official are subject to a request under the Public Records Act. Records of certain volunteers are excluded from the definition of public record. Records are excluded when they are not otherwise required to be retained and are held by volunteers who do not serve in an administrative capacity, have not been appointed by the agency to an agency board, commission, or internship, and do not have a supervisory role or delegated agency authority. Any person wishing to inspect or copy public records of an agency should submit the request to the agency, preferably in writing, using the agency's request form. The Public Records Act doesn't prescribe any official format for a valid request, so an agency must honor valid requests for identifiable records regardless of the format of the request. While using an agency's form is not required, it is typically the most efficient way to submit a request. A requester who chooses not to use an agency form must give the agency fair notice that he or she is submitting a request for public records. Agencies are required to honor requests received in person during an agency's normal office hours or by email. If an agency has adopted reasonable rules on how requests should be submitted, the agency may rely on those rules. The agency should be helpful to the requester in explaining how a request should be submitted and to whom. Records shall be available for inspection and copying upon request for identifiable records. So requesters should give a reasonable description of the records, enabling the agency to search for potentially responsive records. A request for all or substantially all of an agency's records is not a proper request for identifiable records. A request regarding a particular topic or containing a particular keyword or name shall not be considered a request for all of an agency's records. A request for information is not the same as a request for public records. The Public Records Act does not apply to requests for information. There is no duty to create a record that does not exist in order to fulfill a request for records or information. However, requests for information are at times easier to fulfill. Fulfilling a request for information may avert a large public records request. An agency must promptly respond to public records requests. Within 5 business days of receiving a request, an agency must respond. An initial response may be any one of the following: acknowledging receipt of the request and providing a reasonable estimate to respond, or fulfilling the request, or providing an internet address and link to the records on the agency's website, or seeking clarification, while also, to the greatest extent possible, providing an estimate of time for further response if the request is not clarified, or denying the request with an accompanying written statement of the specific reasons. Reasonably clear requests for identifiable records may require no clarification. However, some requests are unclear. Seeking clarification permits the agency to identify responsive records, which in turn will aid in determining the scope of the request. Clarifying the request provides the fullest assistance to the requester, so that the requester receives and pays for only those copies that are desired. Clarification may also result in prompt disclosure by identifying only those records desired. An agency should not seek clarification if the request is for identifiable records and is reasonably clear. If the entire response is unclear and the requester fails to respond to the agency's request for clarification, the agency need not respond to it. However, the agency must respond to those portions of a request that are clear. An agency may deny a bot request, which is a request that was automatically generated by a computer program or script, when it is one of multiple requests from the requester received within a 24-hour period. The agency must establish that responding to the bot request would cause excessive interference with other essential agency functions. A requester is typically not required to provide the reason for a request, unless a law necessitates additional information from the requester. Agencies and requesters are encouraged to promptly communicate with each other if there are issues regarding a request. An agency's initial response to a public records request must provide a reasonable estimate for the time to respond when more time is needed. A reasonable estimate should account for many factors, including the time to have the requester clarify the request if needed, as well as time to assemble and review the records, provide notice to affected persons or agencies if needed, to redact exempt information, and to create a withholding or exemption log. An agency should not use the same estimate for every request. Rather, each reasonable estimate should be based on factors such as the complexity of the request, other pending requests, agency resources, and other agency essential functions. It's a good practice for an agency to briefly explain to the requester the basis for the estimate in the initial response. Extending the estimate is appropriate when circumstances have changed or additional information has come to light. Agencies are encouraged to briefly explain the need to revise an estimate. An agency bears the burden of showing that its search was adequate. Consequently, agencies should be able to document how a search was conducted and, for example, what search terms it used, as well as the location searched. An adequate search depends on the facts of each request, but it is one that is reasonably calculated to uncover all responsive documents in whatever form, paper or electronic. An agency must make more than a perfunctory search and follow obvious leads as they are uncovered. The search should not be limited to one or more locations if there are additional places where responsive records are likely to be found. If responsive public records are likely to be found on or in an agency employee's or official's personal device or account, the employee or official must search those devices and accounts for responsive records. It is possible to conduct an adequate search and still not locate a responsive document. However, if a responsive record is not located and or if challenged in court, the agency will have to prove its search was adequate. make records available during its customary office hours for a minimum of 30 hours per week. Public records are presumed to be open for inspection and copying unless a specific law exempts the record or information from disclosure. Agencies can deliver copies of records to a requester in a number of ways, such as providing links to the records that are on the agency's website, providing paper copies of paper records or scanned copies of paper records by mail or making them available for pickup, or providing electronic records by various methods. You may recall that with respect to what is a public record, the Public Records Act does not distinguish between paper and electronic records. Most agencies create records in an electronic format. A copy of an electronic record should be produced in the requested electronic format if reasonably feasible. Translating a record into an alternative electronic format at the request of the requester, or scanning a paper record, is not creating a new record. Metadata is information embedded in a document that provides detail about the document's characteristics. This may include information such as when the document was created, edited, recipients, and so forth. Non-exempt metadata must be disclosed when expressly requested. When agencies obtain new technologies, they should consider not only the agency's business operation needs, but also records retention and disclosure requirements. Examples of such technologies are portals through which records can be requested and delivered, electronic redaction tools, or retention software, just to name a few. In addition, agencies can look at whether they can make use of their current technology more robust. The legislature encourages agencies to make public records widely available electronically, particularly commonly requested records. For example, an agency could make commonly requested records available on its website. Then, as noted earlier, an agency could fulfill its obligation to provide access to a public record by providing a requester with a link to a specific agency webpage containing the electronic copy of the requested record. For requesters without access to the internet, an agency could provide a computer terminal at its office. Agencies should develop policies addressing technology concerns, such as if and when agency employees may use personal devices for public agency uses, and what responsibilities and requirements therefore attach to the employee. An agency may receive a broad request that asks for any and all records related to a topic. Agencies may not deny a request solely because it is overly broad. As noted, a request for all or substantially all of an agency's records is not a valid request. But a request for all records regarding a particular topic or containing a particular keyword or name is not a request for all of an agency's records. After an initial search shows there are potentially hundreds or thousands of different types of responsive or potentially responsive records, a public records officer should contact the requester to explain the estimated total number of records that would need to be searched, or provide other information describing the anticipated scope of the search. Then the agency could seek clarification to ask if the requester wants all of the different types of responsive records and is willing to pay for all the copies, or instead, if the requester is seeking only some of the records. Good communication can assist both the agency and the requester. A broad request will usually result in a longer estimate of time for disclosure, as well as producing records in batches or installments. When seeking clarification, to the greatest extent possible, the agency must provide a reasonable estimate of time the agency will require to respond to the request if it is not clarified. In many instances, a requester will narrow the scope of the request to enable the agency to provide disclosure more promptly and less expensively. An agency may manage broad requests in a couple ways. An agency may require a deposit in an amount not to exceed 10% of the estimated cost of providing copies for a request. If an agency makes copies in response to a request available on a partial or installment basis, the agency may charge for each part of the request as it is provided. If an installment of a records request is not claimed or reviewed, the agency is not obligated to fulfill the balance of the request. Finally, use of electronic technologies to search, review, redact, and disclose public records can reduce overall costs of compliance for agencies. Agency responses denying in whole or in part inspection or copy of any public record shall include a statement of the specific exemption authorizing the withholding of the record and a brief explanation of how the exemption applies. Exemptions exist throughout the Public Records Act and other state and federal laws. Common exemptions include information such as personal information in files maintained for agency employees if private, pending investigative files compiled by law enforcement or agencies with authority to discipline members of a profession, the non-disclosure of which is essential to effective law enforcement or for the protection of any person's right to privacy, educational records of students in public schools, attorney-client privilege information or work product related to litigation, or protected healthcare information. There is no statute providing a general privacy exemption. If privacy is an express element of a specific exemption, it is only invaded if disclosure would be both highly offensive to the reasonable person and also not of legitimate concern to the public. Exemptions in the Act must be construed narrowly. The general rule is that an agency redacts or withholds only the exempt information and produces the non-exempt information. An acceptable way of providing this information to the requester is with a withholding index, often called an exemption log. The information provided as part of the log should include a description of the type of record or part of record denied. The description should include identifying information from the document. For example, whether the document is a letter or email, the date the document was created or other relevant date, the total number of pages, and the sender and recipients. The exemption log must also include the statutory authority making the information exempt and a brief explanation of how the exemption applies. Some of this information will be evident on the face of the document where redactions have been made to only part of the document. An exemption log, the written explanation, also may be provided in different formats. For example, maybe handwritten or compiled in a spreadsheet or chart, or in a letter, or redactions are marked on the records with exemption codes, and the requester is given the key to the codes. The format of the exemption log or exemptions is not relevant so long as the required information is provided. Any person may inspect non-exempt public records for free. An agency may not charge for the time of staff to search, review, or redact public records when preparing them for inspection. If a requester wants copies of records, an agency has options to charge for copies. It can charge actual costs, or it can charge default fees listed in the Public Records Act, or it can charge an alternative up to $2 fee for an entire request. Some other provisions may be relevant too. In order to charge actual costs, an agency must make available for public inspection and copying a statement of the actual per page or other costs and how it determined actual costs. An agency may adopt its statement of actual costs only after providing notice and a public hearing. When calculating fees, the agency must use the most reasonable, cost-efficient method available to the agency. Staff time to copy and deliver the requested public records may be included in an agency's costs, but an agency may not include staff salaries, benefits, or other general administrative or overhead charges unless those costs are directly related to the actual cost of copying the public records. An example of when an agency may want to charge for the actual cost of staff time is where an agency scans paper records and copies them into an electronic format. The charges should be reasonable and related to the wage of the person likely to be repeatedly assigned to this task. If an agency does not have staff available to make copies, for non-exempt records, an agency may send a scanning or copying project to an outside vendor and pass on the actual cost to the requester. Electronic copy costs may include the actual cost of the electronic production or file transfer of the record, the use of any cloud-based data storage processing service, and the cost of transmitting electronic records, including the use of a physical media device. A second method to charge copy costs is for an agency to choose to use a statutory default fee schedule provided in the Act. In that case, an agency need not calculate actual costs if there's rules or regulations declaring the reasons doing so would be unduly burdensome. The statutory default fee schedule lists, for example, per-page costs for paper records, scanned records, and costs for electronic records. As yet another alternative, an agency can assess an up to $2 flat fee for an entire request when certain conditions are met. The Act includes other fee provisions. For example, an agency cannot charge for access to or downloading of records it routinely posts on its website prior to the receipt of a request, unless the requester specifically asks that the agency provide records through other means. An agency may impose the actual cost of a customized service charge when the request would require the use of IT expertise to prepare data compilations, or when such customized access services are not used by the agency for other business purposes. The agency must notify the requester and take other steps if it chooses to do a customized service. An agency can require an advance 10% deposit before making copies. An agency may enter into a contract, memorandum of understanding, or other agreement with a requester for an alternative fee arrangement or in response to an extensive or frequently occurring request. An agency may choose to waive any charge pursuant to agency rules and regulations. Upon request, an agency must provide a summary of the applicable charges before making copies. The requester then may choose to revise the request to reduce the number of copies and the cost. In sum, the Public Records Act provides an agency several options for assessing charges for copies. The choices selected may vary from agency to agency. Under a different law, the records retention laws at RCW 40.14, agencies must maintain a log of public records requests, including for each request, the identity of the requester if provided, date of receipt, text of request, description of records produced, description of records redacted or withheld and the reasons for doing so, and the date of final disposition. With respect to the identity of the requester, it is possible an agency received only an email address from the requester, and if so, that address would be included in the log. The logs must be retained per the agency's records retention schedule and are a public record. The records retention law also provides that agencies spending at least $100,000 to fulfill requests during the prior fiscal year must report 17 data points about their PRA requests to the Joint Legislative Audit and Review Committee. Under the Public Records Act, any person having been denied an opportunity to inspect or copy a public record may seek further review in the agency. The person may also file a lawsuit to enforce his or her right to access public records. A requester can also file a lawsuit if he or she believes that an agency has not made a reasonable estimate of the time or of the charges to provide public records. Such a lawsuit is to be filed in a court within 1 year of an agency's final definitive response to a request, such as a final claim of exemption or the last production of public records on an installment basis. The agency has the burden of proof to demonstrate that public records were lawfully denied or its estimates were reasonable. If it does not make this showing, an agency will pay the requester's reasonable attorney's fees and costs and may pay potential penalties for denying records in violation of the Public Records Act. A court will consider mitigating and aggravating factors in determining a penalty amount. Lawsuits for public records can be extremely time-consuming and expensive for agencies. Understanding and correctly applying the law is a good risk management tool for state and local government. In rare cases, individual employees may also be civilly or criminally liable under other laws. State agency employees and state officers are subject to the Ethics in Public Service Act. It is a violation of that state ethics law for a state employee or officer to intentionally conceal a public record required to be released under the Public Records Act. State agency employees and officers may be fined up to $5,000 per violation of the state ethics law. It's also a crime for any agency officer to willfully mutilate, destroy, conceal, erase, obliterate, or falsify any record of that agency's office, except where the law expressly authorizes the non-disclosure or destruction of records. The crime is punishable by imprisonment of up to 10 years or a fine of up to $5,000 or both.
Thank you for participating in the Attorney General's Open Government Training. For more information, there are available resources for agencies to receive training and technical assistance for compliance with the Public Records Act. An employee should first consult with its agency's public records officer for routine assistance or training. Additional resources are listed on this website. The Assistant Attorney General for Open Government is also available to write information about the Public Records Act. Thanks again for watching.
Yay, thank you. All right, are there any questions on the PRA training? Anyone going twice? Just a note, we do have, the whole thing, okay, it'll take me a second to bring that back up. The city has three public records officers that are defined. The court has one, that's Pam Haley. The police department has another, that would be Sherry Simonson. And the city hall, which is everyone except the court and police, have another, and that's myself. And as Nancy stated in the training, the model rules were just updated, and in accordance, the city is working on updating our public records policy, which was last updated in 2003. So we thought it would be a good time to revisit that. So at some point, that will be coming back to council, hopefully midway to third quarter of this year. With that, let me just pull up the OPMA training video, and we will get moving.
Why do state legislators, some of their stuff is not open to public records?
They're not subject to these particular laws, but that has been on the floor.
Their taxes and calendars and things. I just wondered, why were they ever treated differently?
Honestly, I don't know too much about that, since that's sort of outside of my purview working for the city, but I can certainly see what that was reported to.
Why they were ever treated differently. Yeah. I mean, they make the rules, I guess, yes.
Well, my understanding was that the Public Records Act came by way of an initiative, and the way that it was written, it somehow excluded state. However, I think a court case just was decided last week that has changed part of that. So some of their records, I think, are now publicly disposable, whereas they weren't before.
Yeah, and I think there was just, I think, an article put out by either AWC or MRSC, so I can see if I can find that again and forward it to the council. And I think it did say that they did sort of say that part of the records of the individual lawmakers were subject to the PRA, however, the legislative records of the actual legislature may not still be applicable. So I'm pretty sure there's a good kind of article that kind of defines that. So if I can find it, I'll send it your way.
Perfect.
Yeah. All right. Let me get this Open Public Meetings Act training up and running. And
how long is this one?
This one is 16 minutes and 24 seconds. Last time we stopped at about a minute early, so shh.
It's always hard to see how you can make a difference, and if my parents stop their life.
16 minutes.
What is this?
We are the largest council up. I can pause and stay up if I want.
No. Too bad, because this is like a whole lot more interesting than the last one.
No, there you go. Yeah.
Oh, wait a minute.
Good job, Liz.
Thank you.
You get all that? No, I did. All
right. Good try. Here we go.
Hi, I'm Washington State Attorney General Bob Ferguson. Joining me in this video is our Open Government Assistant Attorney General, Nancy Perry. This training video provides an overview of the Open Public Meetings Act for both the general public and for public agencies. It is intended to provide a greater understanding of the legal requirements of this important act.
Attention.
The Open Public Meetings Act is a law passed passed by the people of the state of Washington in 1971, at the time of a nationwide effort to make government affairs more accessible and government more responsive. The purpose of the act is to provide the public access to information concerning the conduct of state and local government. The law is based on the principle that open government is essential to a free society. The act provides the people of our state the opportunity to witness the deliberations and the decisions of their government. State and local agencies, such as school boards, city and county councils, and state commissions, must comply with the Open Public Meetings Act. Actions and deliberations of these governing bodies must be conducted openly. Meetings subject to the act must be open to the public, gavel to gavel, unless a law permits a meeting or a part of the meeting to be closed. Thank you so much for watching, and I hope you find this training informative.
This training presentation is not based on the Open Public Meetings Act. The OPMA is in RCW 42.30. This training video contains 15 short segments. The Attorney General just discussed segment one, the history, intent, and purpose of the act. In the remaining segments, we will cover scope of the OPMA, what is a governing body, what is a meeting, what is action, what is final action, travel and gathering, regular meetings, special meetings, executive sessions, public attendance and comment, minutes, liability, other laws, and additional resources. The Act has several clear requirements, and compliance with them is improved with training. Training can mean the difference between complying with the law and expensive litigation. The Act applies to governing bodies of multi-member public agencies, both state and local. Public agency includes A, any state board, commission, committee, department, educational institution, or other state agency which is created by or pursuant to statute other than the courts and the legislature. B, any county, city, school district, special purpose district, or other municipal corporation or political subdivision of the state of Washington. C, any sub-agency of a public agency which is created by or pursuant to statute, ordinance, or other legislative act, including but not limited to planning commissions, library or park boards, commissions and agencies, and D, any policy group whose membership includes representatives of publicly owned utilities formed by or pursuant to the Washington laws when meeting together or on behalf of participants who have contracted for the output of generating plants being planned or built by an operating agency. In some cases, an entity which is not an agency can still be subject to the Act when it is the functional equivalent of a public agency. This determination depends on whether it performs a government function, receives government funding, the extent of government involvement or regulation, and whether the entity was created by government. Examples of public agencies subject to the Act include city councils, county councils, school boards, fire district boards, and state commissions. Agencies governed by an individual, such as a single director, are not subject to the Act. Some activities of public agencies are not subject to the OPMA. They include certain licensing and permitting activities, quasi-judicial matters, matters governed by the Washington State Administrative Procedure Act, APA, and certain collective bargaining activities. All meetings of the governing body of a public agency shall be open and public, and all persons shall be permitted to attend any meeting of the governing body of a public agency, except as otherwise provided in the OPMA. A governing body is defined as the multi-member board, commission, committee, council, or other policy or rulemaking body of a public agency, or any committee thereof, when the committee acts on behalf of the governing body, conducts hearings, or takes testimony or public comment. Meeting means meetings at which action is taken. Physical presence of the members is not required. A meeting can occur by phone, or in some cases, by email. I will talk more about email exchanges later in this video. A meeting does not need to be titled meeting. The OPMA also applies to retreats, workshops, and study sessions. A meeting does not occur if there is not a quorum. Both actions and final actions are subject to the OPMA. Action means the transaction of the official business of a public agency by a governing body, including but not limited to receipt of public testimony, deliberations, discussions, considerations, reviews, evaluations, and final actions. Final action means a collective, positive, or negative decision, or an actual vote by a majority of the members of the governing body when sitting as a body or entity upon a motion, proposal, resolution, order, or ordinance. Final actions must occur in public. Secret ballots are not allowed. A majority of the members of a governing body may travel together or gather for purposes other than a regular meeting or a special meeting, so long as no action is taken. And remember, action includes discussion of agency business. This means a quorum of members can travel to a meeting together, or they can gather at a public or private event, such as a festival or social function, so long as they do not collectively discuss agency business or matters. Regular meetings are recurring meetings held in accordance with a periodic schedule by ordinance, resolution, bylaws, or other rule. State agencies file the notice of regular meetings each year with the Office of the Code Advisor. Regular meeting agendas are going to be posted online on an agency's website 24 hours in advance, unless the agency does not have a website, or if it employs fewer than 10 full-time equivalent employees. Special meetings are meetings that are not regular meetings, called by the presiding officer or a majority of the members. This means they are meetings not on a fixed schedule, such as on a day different than the regularly scheduled meetings. Certain notice requirements apply to special meetings. For example, 24-hour advance written notice must be provided to members of the governing body unless waived, provided to local newspapers, radio, and TV stations that have a request on file, posted on the agency's website if the agency has a website, unless other exceptions apply for agencies with a few staff, and prominently displayed at the main entrance and the meeting site. The notice must specify the time, place, and business to be transacted. There is an exception to the notice requirements for emergency special meetings. Those are meetings involving injury or damage to persons or property, or the likelihood of injury or damage, where time requirements make notice impractical and increase likelihood of injury or damage. Under the OPMA, an executive session is a part of a regular or special meeting that is closed to the public for the limited purposes listed in the OPMA. The grounds for holding an executive session are narrowly construed. The purpose of the executive session and the time it will end must be publicly announced before excluding the public, and the time can be extended by further announcement. Examples of purposes include certain real estate discussions, reviewing negotiations on publicly bid contracts under certain conditions, evaluating the qualifications of an applicant for public employment, and meeting with legal counsel regarding enforcement actions, litigation, or potential litigation. The OPMA provides a list of authorized executive session purposes at RCW 42.30.110. In addition, a public agency can have a closed meeting to discuss matters not subject to the OPMA, such as deliberating on a quasi-judicial matter. Other laws may provide additional procedures or authority for particular meetings or hearings, or a particular agency. An agency must carefully follow the law when meeting in an executive or closed session. For example, when meeting in an executive session under the OPMA to discuss agency enforcement actions, litigation, or potential litigation, there are three requirements. First, legal counsel representing the agency must be present. Second, the purpose is to discuss an agency enforcement action, litigation, or potential litigation to which the agency, governing body, or a member acting in an official capacity is a party or is likely to become a party. And finally, public knowledge regarding the discussion is likely to result in an adverse legal or financial consequence to the agency. Remember, an agency can discuss only those matters in an executive session under the OPMA that it has told the public it would discuss. The members cannot talk about other topics in that executive session. As we discussed, all meetings of the governing body of a public agency shall be open and public, and all persons shall be permitted to attend any meeting of the governing body of a public agency, except as otherwise provided in the OPMA. An agency also cannot place conditions on attendance, such as requiring persons to register their names or fill out a questionnaire before attending. As noted, email or phone call discussions among members of a governing body can be a meeting under the OPMA. But the purpose of the OPMA is to permit the public to attend and observe agency meetings. So when the public is unable to attend email or phone call discussions that are meetings under the OPMA, the Act has been violated. For example, it is generally agreed that the members can meet via a teleconference call so long as, one, any public notice procedures are satisfied, and two, an agency sets up a process for the public to attend, such as having a speakerphone available at the agency's official meeting location so the public can hear the discussion. In contrast, since an email exchange among a quorum of members of a governing body is not open to the public, such an exchange in which action takes place is a meeting that would violate the OPMA. And remember again, action is broadly defined. Those email exchanges do not comply with public notice and attendance requirements for regular or special meetings. The OPMA does not include a requirement that public agencies allow public comment. Nevertheless, many public agencies do permit some public comment period at a meeting, such as at the beginning of a meeting. Agencies can put reasonable procedures in place to allow for public comment, and the OPMA has procedures for dealing with disruptions when the orderly conduct of the meeting is unfeasible. The minutes of all regular and special meetings, except executive sessions of such boards, commissions, agencies, or authorities, shall be promptly recorded, and such records shall be open to public inspection. That law does not require any specific format for minutes. That law also does not require an audio or video recording of a meeting, although many agencies make such recordings. We have advised that the minutes should, at a minimum, recite the significant actions of the agency. Violations of the OPMA can result in a lawsuit against an agency and its members. A court can impose a $500 civil penalty as personal liability against each member who attends a meeting in knowing violation of the OPMA, and a $1,000 penalty for a subsequent knowing violation. A court can declare any action taken at a meeting not held in compliance with the OPMA null and void. And a court will award costs and attorney's fees to a successful party seeking a remedy under the OPMA. To recap, this presentation covers the highlights of the Open Public Meetings Act. Public agencies may be subject to other laws governing other particular meeting or hearing procedures or governing particular agencies. And the laws concerning agency meetings and hearings can also be amended from time to time. Therefore, agencies are cautioned to be mindful of all the current laws concerning their meeting and hearing procedures.
Thanks for participating in the Attorney General's Open Government Training. For more information, there are resources available for agencies to receive training and technical assistance for compliance with the Open Public Meetings Act. An official should first consult with his agency's counsel for routine assistance and for training. Additional resources are listed on this website. The Assistant Attorney General for Open Government, Nancy Greer, is also available to provide information about the Open Public Meetings Act.
Okay, so that completes the two training pieces we're going to do tonight. As a reminder, we are not going into detail on records retention. However, that is part of the Open Government training, so I encourage you to review the training that I'm going to go ahead and send out. And it is actually part of the agenda bill link, so even if you go to the agenda bill and you go down to these last two bullet points here and review these on your own, that would cover your requirements for records retention. That is done by the Washington State Archives. The important features to note about that records retention is that that tells you how long you have to keep records, and it also defines different categories of records. So when you are all out into the public or collecting records on your own, it's worth taking a moment to think of, is this the only copy? Secondary copies can be thrown away as long as you know where the original is being maintained. So for instance, because you all have email addresses through the city, the original emails are kept here at the city. You don't need to worry about that, but anything that you're receiving in the course of business that you want retained, either make sure you're taking care of it yourself or go ahead and pass it on to the city for retention. So hopefully you found this information compelling tonight, and we have yet again met your requirements for the Open Government training. And if there's no questions.
Okay, move to adjourn.
Wow.
Okay, do we want to get council member reports? We're good. We're good. Okay, there's a motion to adjourn from Councilmember Anthony. Second from Councilmember Camps. Any discussion on the motion to adjourn? Seeing none, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed? Abstentions? Motion passes. Have a great day.
Thank you.
Have a great evening. Thank you. We're adjourned.